You might think Grammarly is a fancy spell check, but your team has been using and loving it for years because it does way more than you realize. Grammarly's AI can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have an extra special guest. Antti Ilmanen is AQR's co-head of the Portfolio Solutions Group. He is the author of a new book, Investing Amid Low Expected Returns, Making the Most When the Markets Offer the Least. He has an incredible CV full of all sorts of awards and has worked at all sorts of places like Salomon Brothers and Brevin Howard before ending up at AQR. If you're at all interested in value investing, factor investing, understanding how your starting condition leads to future returns that might be better or worse than historical averages, you're going to find this to absolutely be a masterclass in investing. I found it absolutely fascinating, and I think you will as well. With no further ado, my conversation with AQR's Antti Ilmanen. Welcome to Bloomberg.
Thanks, Barry. I'm really looking forward to this.
Same here. So first, I found the book to be quite fascinating, very in-depth, and you managed to take some of the more technical arcana and make it very understandable. We'll circle back with that. Let's start just by talking about your career. You began as a central bank portfolio manager in Finland.
So yeah, my really first stroke of luck, I think, was getting that job. Before that, I had been nerdy kid with interest in esoteric things like royal family trees or track and field statistics, not trading. And when I was studying in university economics, I did not really get the passion. The passion came when I went to invest the country's foreign exchange reserves there. And it was very much global government bond markets. Mm-hmm. So thinking about macro picture, I never then nor later had, I don't know, much interest in single stock picking. So thinking of the big picture, and there were some lovely things like I was there in the October 87 crash and saw 2-year yields falling in one overnight from 9.5% to 7.5%. You don't see those movements.
That's a giant move. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So anyway, that was a great learning experience. And then my second related stroke of luck was that Professor Ken French came there.
Oh, really? Dartmouth.
He came to educate us in 1989 and teach sort of what we were doing, what we should be doing. And I was this enthusiastic kid there. Well, by that time I was already almost 28. And he, when I was expressing some interest about studying in the US, he was saying, well, you should do it soon. You are sort of old enough to do that. And a few months later, I was in the US, and it was so lucky in my life because that year I met then Cliff Asness and John Liu, who later founded AQR. So as my fellow students, I met my wife there. She was an MBA student from Germany and would have left a few months later.
University of Chicago.
Mm-hmm. So all of this luck sort of was related to my wonderful first job. So
right.
I'm eternally grateful.
And Gene Fama teaches there, and his research partner is Ken French.
Yeah. Both Cliff, actually all three, Cliff, John, and I, we had Fama and French as our dissertation chairman, and that's a small source of pride.
Right. Little intimidating. So yeah. So you go from Chicago. Is that how you ended up at Salomon Brothers?
Yeah. So that relationship actually already started when I was a portfolio manager. I, funnily enough, actually, like one of these Michael Lewis's Liar's Pokers, mm-hmm. Good Guys was one of my sales contacts there.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. He didn't have many good guys, but one was. Anyway, so I got to know people like Marty Leibovitz before I went mm-hmm. to Chicago, and I think he may have had a hand somewhere there. And so when I finished my studies, it was pretty clear that I wasn't sort of academic enough. I wanted to go to either buy side or sell side. I even talked to the G somewhere, Cliff and John Ware, didn't go there. Sort of thought from my 80s experience that buy side is dusty, wrong choice. Anyway, so I then went to Salomon Brothers, did bond research for a couple of years on yield curve strategies, then moved to Europe. That was always a deal with my wife, mm-hmm. to be a bond strategist at Salomon for many years. Initially very discretionary, but gradually becoming more and more systematic, and mm-hmm. And eventually sort of turned from this customer-oriented role to prop trading for a while.
And then how did you end up at Brevan Howard?
Yeah, so I think that from these times when I was strategist, I was talking to to great people, like, you know, earlier on some LTCM and then various other people, including Alan, who came actually from Salomon. And so somewhere 2003, he sort of invited me to try to be a mini Cliff, a systematic trader with a small team there at Brevan Howard, which was in some sense great, but it is sort of a misfit because it's a very discretionary place.
Right.
And so trying to do systematic in that environment was harder, and I think none of us were doing extremely well, none of us were doing extremely badly, but it just didn't become a great
success. Just not a great fit.
Yeah. But it was on the other hand, it was just a great place, well, first to try it, but the second thing is that when 2008 came along, it was one of the few places that were making money, so it was a very comfortable vantage mm-hmm. point for that environment.
How did you go from being a mini Cliff-ass nest to a maxi Cliff-ass nest?
Yeah, so... I had stopped at systematic trading, but I had been talking with those guys often of possibly joining. It was a matter also of them opening European office because that's mm-hmm. where I was physically, and so that was approaching. It also helped that I basically decided to write this book, Expected Returns. And when I wrote it, I asked Cliff to write the foreword for it. And by the way, like if you haven't looked, like check sometime the first words he has there. Like it was, I was sweating when I read that. it starts by telling that first time I met Antti, I thought he was insane, and I was right. So that was a little stressful, but he turns it out very nice. But anyway, so that experience reminded, I think, both of us how aligned our thinking is based mm-hmm. on this common background. And that somehow, I think, motivated them to offer and me to say yes, to the idea of joining them, really what I would think as getting to my natural home. And mm-hmm. that happened in 2011.
So you've been there for more than a decade. You're now co-head of Portfolio Solutions. What is that role like? What's your day-to-day yeah. work like at AQR Capital?
Yeah, so the Portfolio Solutions Group advises mainly institutional clients on all kinds of challenges that they have on thinking about expected returns, portfolio construction, risk management, etc. And then in addition, we write lots of papers. I speak in many conferences. And then in addition to that, I've had a hand in designing and improving some of our strategies, especially related to style premia. That was something I was quite passionate about when I joined. And by now I'm co-head, the guy who has collaborated very closely with me, Dan Villalon, has taken more and more over the day-to-day running of the thing. And I took time to write the second book recently, and now I'm talking about it. And I think with my age, I'm happy to sort of move to part-time status, I think.
Hmm. So in the book, Cliff Asness again does the introduction, and he says, you overshare, a great characteristic for someone to research, but he sometimes says he's afraid you're going to reveal the secret sauce. Explain oversharing of financial research.
Yeah, so this is related to all of us having this University of Chicago experience, where we were really taught the value of being open and putting your research out there for public scrutiny to improve it and to educate. But of course, there are possible downsides to that, and that has been always a question. So I'm not, and we are not writing about all the proprietary strategies that we have, but we are talking quite openly about some things like, again, styles, factor investing, alternative risk premia, things that are relatively widely known. And I have this, I don't know, yeah, I'm certainly leaning that way of being too transparent, and then somebody may have to control me a little.
So let's just talk a little bit about two of the key themes in the book. The first is alpha. It's the holy grail, but also elusive and costly. Explain.
Alpha is something we all aspire for, but in reality, the evidence is very limited that most investors can deliver alpha. Moreover, there's a lot of good research by others and us showing that much what people think is alpha can be explained by either, you know, hedge funds running,
taking on more risk,
lots of equity correlation,
right,
or then correlation to these various styles that are not quite market beta, but it's certainly not pure alpha either.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow this type of demystifying, I think, is helpful. But it's clear that investors tend to be, managers and investors tend to be overconfident in their ability to find that elusive alpha.
So I'm glad you brought that up, because there's another bullet point in the last chapter of the book, which strikes me, let me read it, quote, discipline, humility, and patience as a key to investing success. That sounds more like behavioral finance than factor investing.
Yeah. So one other founder, David Kabiller, he's always had this very good point that good investment results require good investment strategies and good investors. And so we wrote the paper together almost a decade ago on bad habits and good practices and really thinking about those things. And it does definitely get to behavioral vices. In general, I think behavioral finance literature focuses way too much on how you can exploit other people's mistakes as opposed to looking in the mirror and reducing your own mistakes. So,
Really quite interesting. So let's talk a little bit about some of the concepts about expected returns. You mention in the beginning of the book, lower asset yields and richer asset prices have pulled forward future returns. In other words, a lot of the gains we've seen in the 2010s, and I would guess 21 and 22, weren't so much based on that multiple and of earnings, but future multiples that were pulled forward into that time period. Explain that.
It's always good to think of starting yields and valuation sort of as two sides of the same coin. So starting yields of all major assets were coming down in last decade and last decades, actually several decades. So something that I try to make investors see that they naturally think of this way also of expected returns with bonds, but when they think of equities or housing, they sort of look at the rear view mirror and think of historical average returns that can be distorted by this richening or cheapening quite a lot. So I think it's helpful to think that all of these long-only investments are priced by thinking of expected cash flows discounted by a common discount rate, the riskless part, and some various asset-specific premia. And now when this common discount rate has been at all-time lows, And was coming down for decades. So that was making everything expensive at the same time, whatever happened to the expected cash flows and other premia. And so that situation has gotten us to this sort of everything bubble, as some say. And I think it's bubble is a bit wrong word there, in the sense that there is a fundamental story behind it.
Mm-hmm.
The low real yields that were influencing all kinds of investments.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words. and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Makes a lot of sense. You wrote this book in 2021, or at least finished it in 2021, and you describe in the book what you see as an, quote, investment winter ahead. I have to say that seems pretty prescient considering since you handed the book in to be published last year, markets have pretty much done nothing but roll over and head south in 2022. Was this just lucky timing or were you a little prescient?
No, I'll put it largely to lucky timing. But so the story I was always saying that we know that we've got these low expected returns given those low starting yields. And by the way, related to what you're saying, I really like another statement. We borrowed returns from the future right. when we were capitalizing everything at those expensive levels. And so that locked in low future returns. We just didn't know whether that's going to materialize through slow pain, staying in this low expected return world, or fast pain cheapening. And so then in the book, I was saying that I don't really have a strong view on this one, but in conclusions, I did put there that it just seems that stars are aligning for some fast pain. And it wasn't just the high valuations, but there was a catalyst. There was this basically the inflation problem was seemingly getting us close to the day when Fed finally has to make some hard choices. Mm-hmm. And so that I got right, but I would say that I was really lucky because I could have written it 6 months earlier. And in general, I've had other market timing calls. I'm not famous for being good at market timing. I don't know anybody who is. There are no old gold market timers in Forbes right. billionaire lists.
Right. There's old and there's bold, but there's not both. Let's talk a little bit about the pushback to low expected returns. You know, following the financial crisis and the Fed cutting rates, economy and the market starts to recover in late 2009 and then 2010. And we kept hearing from a lot of different value corners, hey, everything is richly priced. Bonds are the most expensive they've been in 30 years. Stocks are pricey. Lower your return expectations. But yet the 2010s saw returns in equities and bonds close to double historical averages. How do we explain why that advice took so long before it started to work?
So I think there is a fair risk that anybody who was talking like that is thought as the boy who cried wolf and losing credibility then by this time. And I think that would be sad because I think sometime it's going to really work and this year really looks like it can be that sometime. And I felt always somewhat good that we were not predicting mean reverting valuations that would right. have made things work. We were saying, let's be really humble about any market timing use of this stuff, but low starting yields do anchor expected returns lower. But it's true that, and what we saw then in that decade, that rich things can get richer and that sure. can take quite a long time. And so actually my favorite quote is to think about what happened to S&P 500, the Shiller PE. That went from mildly above historical average 20 to double and wildly above average 40 in 10 years' time. And that type of thing gives you, well, basically 7% annual returns prorated then. And so that's the key reason. And something similar happened. Real yields on bonds were already low. They went even lower. Rental yields on equities, credit spreads, anything you look at had basically tailwinds from these falling yields. And that repricing then gave high returns. And that there's a danger that people then look at the rearview mirror and become complacent right. just at the wrong time.
So let's talk a little bit about that. How significant was the ultra low rates of the Federal Reserve to making all of these different asset classes richly valued and continuing to generate strong returns right up until the Fed started raising rates?
So I think, so short term, what happened this year was really, there was a catalyst of inflation and Fed tightening, but the long term story was always about valuations. And the important thing, as I said, is related to this common part, the low real yields. And should we blame Fed for that, or should we blame somehow greedy investors? I buy more the stories that there was this fundamental effects, most importantly probably savings glut, excess savings coming from pension savers. Also another story is that when the wealthy were getting a bigger share of the pie, their savings rates are higher. There are research on both fronts which mm-hmm. sort of explain why we've gotten this exceptional savings glut, which was then pushing all assets yields lower and creating this. And Fed and investors were basically then responding to that situation rather than driving it.
Now, we heard a lot about the savings glut from then-chairman Ben Bernanke in the early 2000s. Is this savings glut qualitatively different than what we saw 2 decades ago?
Yeah, it's the same idea. So always when you think of real yields, you think that, okay, there's either an issue with investments or savings, and it's a balance between those two. And he was highlighting that this probably is more coming from the savings side. And then he was emphasizing that this is a China and often emerging market foreign reserves, those types of excess savings were sort of the culprit for the conundrum in 2005 or whatever it was. And I think that story still has some legs, but sort of the key culprit then became demographics and retirement savers, and the latest story now is in the sort of the 1%.
So the flip side of that, if there's a savings glut, meaning a big uptick in demand for that paper, does that also suggest we have a dearth of high quality sovereign paper of bonds issued by countries like the US or the UK, or is it just whatever the existing supply of paper is, what it is, and it's the demand that has spiked?
Yeah, I think the demand has been driving things, and the supply has been there. Like there's been plenty of supply as well to cater for it, and really, given the need for the to cover the public deficits and so on. But again, I think if one thinks of what sort of started this among fundamental forces, I'd choose to go with that savings glut. My best reading of the literature.
Makes some sense. So you wrote the prior book a decade ago, 2011, Just Expected Returns. In the decade between that book and this book, what have we all learned? What has the markets taught us? And how did you work that into the new book?
Well, I like the basic framework still in the book, but I think certainly it was a terrible decade for all kinds of contrarian strategies, and I have become even more humble. It's sort of funny that I wrote my dissertation 40 years ago on duration timing, and I've thought about all kinds of market timing. Every decade I become more humble about the endeavor. And yet, even as I told, like at the end of this latest book, I'm still mentioning stars are aligning, and it might be. So the temptation is there, but I think the main point I want to say is I think we should really try to think of investing as a strategic effort, good diversification and so on, as opposed to some great tactical timing, because that doesn't do too well. So I think that would be, and partly, you know, relearned through the difficulty of contrarian timing strategies. Then another thing which was very important in this decade was there was a growing interest in these diversifying return sources. But I think by now, the most popular one is related to illiquid investments, whereas my favorites were then and are still now more liquid strategies, various style, premium value investing, trend following, and so mm-hmm. on and so on.
So one of the interesting things you talk about in the book is that we continue to find more data, not just the decade of data that went by, but historical data, old data, going back to the 1800s. I have to ask, where is this, do we call it ancient? Where is this 19th century data coming from, and how can you apply it to investing in the 21st century?
Yeah, so the first point is that we accrue out of sample new experience so slowly that it's sort of painful to do that waiting. And And therefore, it is helpful supplementary source to get some old data sources. Most early studies were done with data since 1960s to 90s, and then it was extended to beginning of CRISP data, 1926. Right. And now we've had people going further back, and I am, so I haven't been one of those in the archives, but I'm one of those looking at that data and studying it critically and seeing what we can learn from there, mainly whether you get similar patterns. I do love it when I find that some strategies have worked persistently over different centuries, pervasively across different countries and asset classes, and robust with different specifications. So that makes me more confident. But I have recognized, and that's something I say in the book as well, that when people see my 100 and 200 years of data there, some just roll their eyes and
why is that?
Yeah, why do I care about 200 years of data? I really care about last 3 years with my own portfolio.
Well, obviously, that's a very specific sample set. You want to go way beyond that. But it raises, people rolling their eyes raise the question, how reliable is that data? How accurate is it? Can we have confidence that it's been cleanly assembled? Because the technology of the 1800s, a little more manual than today.
All fair. So I'll just say, well, first I say, you just do the best you can. And sure. I think so there's some value in the data, but there are data problems, there are investability questions, even if the data were fine, maybe
right.
you couldn't do foreign diversification or something like, well, actually before First World War, maybe you could, that was pretty international era. And then there's a whole criticism that the world has structurally changed, and that criticism has more bite the further back you go. So I think for all these reasons, we should be skeptical, but I still like it as a supplementary evidence, not as main motivation for anything.
So yes. You mentioned diversification earlier. In the last section of the book, you write an ode to diversification. Tell us about that.
Sure. I do think, you know, it's a cliche, but diversification is pretty close to a free lunch, and it is a wonderful, wonderful aid to improving portfolios. I think it's much easier to improve your risk-adjusted returns through good risk diversification than by getting somehow greater insights in one particular strategy. So so I write about it both the, I don't know, the simple maths about it, how you can double Sharpe ratios with four uncorrelated strategies, and then remind that it's really difficult to find four uncorrelated strategies in long-only world. You may have to get to long-short world to take advantage of those types of opportunities. And then I'm the flip side of that. I am saying that diversification has got some critics. Of course, there's diversification or that diversification fails when most needed and so on. And I think I can counter those to some extent. But I think there are challenges. Good risk diversification often then requires you to use some shorting and leverage, and there are limits to how much people want to mm-hmm. do that. There's unconventionality issues. And then there's this, what we've highlighted in recent years, that you sort of inherently, you lack stories. And so it's very sort of, I don't know, math-oriented or algebra-oriented type of thing, as opposed to great stories which drive most investment passions.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. You mentioned free lunch. You talk about rebalancing, arguably another free lunch. Tell us your thoughts on rebalancing.
Yeah, so rebalancing, I think, is a way of ensuring that you can retain your risk targets and you can retain your diversification. So I think of it primarily as that. There's a follow-up question whether you can get better returns and then how you do it and so on. And I talk a little. I think I wouldn't be too strict on rebalancing. I think like one good idea is to be somewhat lazy with rebalancing strategies. So something like that, or maybe four times a year, but part of the portfolio.
Right.
So you are sort of averaging. You don't get so dependent on when you did it during
right.
the year. So that type of thing. But basically, if you are a little lazy or patient with rebalancing, you let the near-term momentum play out and you might get closer to the time when there's mean reversion advantages. So you are trying to play a little bit these advantages that tend to be in financial markets with momentum and mean reversion.
So let's talk a little bit about low expected returns. We already talked about the impact on Fed rates. What else goes into driving valuation factors that can lower future expected returns?
It really depends on what horizon we talk about. So monetary policy, macro conditions are very important for short term. But I think I'd like to focus, and I do focus in the book mainly on long term expected returns. And then it
long term being seven years?
5 to 10 years, something like that. And yeah, it's interesting. If you go even further, then sort of valuations even don't matter. Sort of everything gets diluted. And then you have to think about what's some theoretical long run return. But so sort of for 10 years ahead, then starting yields and valuations are essential. And again, so I think those are a very helpful anchor for thinking about those returns, even though you can get these very ugly forecast errors like what happened in the last decade. But when such a thing happens, then it pretty much stores problem for the future. So last decade, assets richened, it just meant that, well, you are going to have even more problems in those future returns. And I think the only way you can sort of solve the low expected return problem here is, at least for risky assets, is that there would be this much faster growth, this techno-optimism that you hear in some quarters. And there I say could be, but we've had wonderful technological advances last 100 years. And 2% real growth is pretty much as good as it gets.
And that's the interesting thing, because you talk in the book about very often mom and pop investors, individual investors, tend to confuse GDP growth with expected returns. Academically, we know there's almost no correlation between the two, is there?
It's surprising that whether you look at over time in one country or you look at across countries, the relation is very modest. And my favorite poster boy on that one is China, which had this 30 years of very fast GDP growth.
Massive growth.
And for equity investors, it was a really sorry story.
Yeah, no, it was a lost opportunity. If you piled into China in 1990, you missed a lot of opportunity elsewhere in the world.
Yep.
It's quite amazing.
Yeah. And there are some stories why that's the case. Like basically, you know, one logic is that GDP growth doesn't capture how the pie is shared between corporates and so on. And there's a different sector compositions. There's public versus unlisted sectors. All kinds of questions like this that can then mechanically explain why this happens. But it is it's a weird result, and it's understandable. And I think it commonly motivates people to look for those fast-growing countries and taking it for granted that that's a good equity investment.
So when we're thinking about various asset classes, how does cash work into that allocation strategy? Is that a legitimate asset class, or is it just a drag on future returns, except for years like 2022?
Well, even in 2022, again, in relative sense, cash is, of course, doing fine. But the real return in cash is whatever, -5%. It just happens to be better than even more bearish results. And so I think one interesting thing is that you need to have some market timing ability, I think, to make cash useful and use it almost as an option. And then it matters whether you have got some interesting yield levels. 20 years ago, you had that 3-4% real return on cash, not around in this situation. So I do think that the main story with cash is, like you said, like there's something about the drag in it. It dilutes. It's not a great diversifier. It dilutes the performance. It would be good if you have got some great market timing skills, but let's be humble about it. Often I'd even say that cash may be best used as a, basically on the other side, like you want to use it for leverage for some long short strategies. And so that may be a helpful answer, what you do with that.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the book, I like the way you describe certain investor types based on their future liabilities. So pensions, endowments, defined benefit plans. You point out that they're particularly sensitive to low expected returns. Tell us, what makes them so susceptible? Is it the future liabilities they have? Why is merely the concept of lower expected returns so problematic for them?
Yeah, well, I think it is for any investor, but if you have made some commitments for the future, then it is maybe more legally binding, and that makes it tougher than for somebody who can basically adjust expectations or try to just live through these things without sort of recognizing the low expected return until somewhere far into the future.
So let's talk about far into the future. How long should we expect lower returns for? Is this a question of quarters or years and decades? Is this cyclical? Does it eventually turn over? Tell us a little bit about duration of expected returns.
Sure. So the main story of the book is about those low starting years, and therefore we are talking of long run story. Then I'll sort of turn into more speculative pundit here by thinking about the current situation, where I do think that we are now in this fast pain situation where we will probably get more, we will surely get more monetary policy tightening, and I suspect that the latest market positivism on yields is maybe way too optimistic. I think you will need more tightening to control inflation. And again, this is a speculative talk here. So I think fast pain will be with us for various risky assets, but I think there will be a limit to it because of the structural forces. I refer to the savings glut. I think that's not going away anytime soon, and therefore there's going to be a lid on how far yields can rise, and that mm-hmm. and basically those bond yields, they have been underwriting high valuations on all other on stocks and real estate and so on, and those rising yields have been very important in cheapening those other asset classes, and so I think there's going to be more pain on that front, but not too much. I don't think we will get so much higher yields and cheaper asset valuations that we would sort of solve the long run problem of low expected returns. We will still get some pain, but I think the slow pain will be with us quite a long time.
So let me see if I can explain that, if I understand that. We've had a savings glut that has put a cap on interest rates, which means that the cost of capital has been very low, and therefore that allowed us to speculate in real estate, in equity, and that allowed valuations to go high. And what's going to determine how much those multiples compress is how high rates end up going up. Am I oversimplifying that?
No, that is right. And again, we have got now this cyclical situation where basically the inflation problem forced finally central banks to act quite aggressively then on the interest rate front. And then how much more they have to do is going to be important in the near term, but I just don't see a scenario where they would raise rate so much that we would get back to the kind of 4-5% expected real returns on 60-40 portfolios, which used to be there. We are about half of that nowadays. We've come from the lows, but we are still, like, let's say 60-40, 2% real yield is roughly the number, as opposed to the 4+ long run.
So we're recording this the first week of July. The Fed has already raised 75 basis points on top of their previous 50 basis points. For a while, the consensus is that the end of July, I think it's the 27th, that meeting, seemed to be 75 basis points. It sounds like fears of recession might drive that down to 50 basis points, but clearly there's no consensus there yet. How far do you think the Fed's going to go in tightening? And do we run the risk that we're behind the curve in 2021? Are we running the risk that they're getting ahead of themselves in 2022?
Yeah. First, just a qualifier here that
nobody knows.
Nobody knows, and we don't trade on my views. We don't like this is that's important, and it's incredibly difficult. But yeah, we certainly do think about those issues a lot. And I'm pretty much in, let's say, Larry Summers' camp. They're thinking that it's very hard to get the immaculate disinflation here, and you will need Fed needs to do more to get that inflation into control. And if it does, either if it acts more or financial markets drop enough, then there's going to be some pretty bad outcomes to risky assets. Without that, I think we are going to continue to have that inflation problem. There's a narrow path how it could go in a more benign way, and market seems to be clutching that straw right now.
So what would make you change your mind? What would lead you to say, oh, I've been too cautious about future expected returns, and because A, B, and C happen, I think we could get a little more confident?
Yeah. So I think the long horizon estimates are very difficult to change. The starting yields are a heavy anchor. So I think it would really require the growth environment to change. Again, I mentioned earlier the technological progress, those types of things. So short term, anything can happen. But,
right.
but somehow you have to have this type of idea of the greater internet usage globally, and all kinds of technological progress moving us from the 2% to 3-4% real
growth.
Which
is hard to do.
Hard to do. Has not happened.
Right. And then you mentioned earlier the cheapening. If stocks got much cheaper, that could potentially change it, the starting valuation. But do we really think that's a likely probability?
Yeah, I would be surprised that we would get that much cheaper. And again, the economic logic I have is there, the savings glut somehow, that basically real yields are not going to allow that. We have two fragile financial markets to allow that much cheapening. So we might be talking of 40-50% further market falls.
And, right. And that seems pretty unlikely at least with the state of the world today. Obviously, that can change any time. That's really quite interesting. So let's talk about some things that seem relatively cheap. Cliff Asness, in the foreword of the book, wrote, quote, "Value premia seems record cheap today." That was the end of 2021. Is value premia still cheap today?
Value premium is still very cheap. And it's been a lovely year in the sense that we have had positive returns, and yet the value spread, this forward-looking measure of how cheap value stocks are versus growth stocks, has remained wide. And partly it is that you get some pullbacks like we have recently gotten, but also we are basically rotating into new value stocks and growth stocks, and the fundamentals have actually further had sort of favorable developments favoring value stocks versus growth stocks. So for all these reasons, we see that value stocks, the way we tend to trade them, are as cheap or even cheaper than they were at the worst times during the dot-com bubble. And it is important to just distinguish, and Cliff wrote about this in a blog recently, that dot-com bubble was very much about tech versus others. And across sectors, we haven't gotten to the new highs, but we tend to focus on within industry stock selection in our value strategies. And with that, the key story of this recent bubble was really markets favoring these disruptive, profitless growth companies within every sector. And that opportunity remains still very wide. And we love seeing like pretty good performance behind us, and then very good runway because those value spreads remain quite wide.
And in the US, I've noticed that small cap value has done much better than the larger cap companies. And then emerging markets, small cap value, last I looked, it might have even been green for the year, might have even been positive returns for the year. Why are small cap doing so well in the value space this year?
Well, it often happens like you just get bigger movements in good and bad on the small caps than large caps.
So I mentioned the quote from Cliff. He's a big character. What's it like working with him?
It's mainly great, though. If you had
him with us here on this studio, I think you wouldn't hear much of me. And and that's just as well, because he's faster on his feet and he's wittier, so that's in everybody's benefit. But it does help that our investment thinking, investment beliefs are so similar. So I really rarely have got any wish to second guess anything he says or does. So that's great. And then most importantly, I do love his ethical antenna and this kind of truth-telling obsession that he has. I mean, sometimes there are overshoots there, but it's a reason for me why I love to work in AQR more than in any other place in financial industry.
Because of Cliff. You know, usually you get a guy who's quantitatively oriented, you tend not to get that sort of articulateness, and you also tend not to get that sort of sense of humor, which is very, very specific to him. He's a very funny guy.
He is, yeah. And I a bit mixed feelings, because there's no way to beat him on those things, but that's okay.
That's very funny. So let's talk a little bit about the things that have changed since you wrote this book. What's going on in the current market? Is it just confirming what your expectations were for future returns? Tell us a little bit about how 2022 has, now that it's half over, how has this impacted the general premise of the book?
Yeah, I think overall I feel totally blessed that we got the book. Came out at a time when markets were roughly acting the way the title was saying, talking about low expected returns. We got low realized returns, so that just sounds great. And it also turns out that some of our strategies, value strategy, trend following, these types of strategies are doing very well. So I'm getting like great response. But of course, some things have happened as expected, related to inflation, central bank tightening. But then I had no idea of what, you know, the geopolitics, Russia, Ukraine, sure, or the greater split we have between US sphere and China and so on. So, and I don't have great insights to this. For us, when I think of the long run expected returns, the key story is that assets have cheapened, as one would have expected in this situation, and the question is whether there's going to be more. I think it is interesting that we've seen the biggest moves in bonds, smaller moves when I think of yield space, not price space, but in yield space, equity yields have risen more, and then illiquid yields have risen so far very little. And of course, there is a smoothing effect, and so that's a. But I do expect that there's going to be an issue. I saw in March when equities didn't instantly respond to rising yields, it reminded me of Wile E. Coyote running over that cliff and sort of waiting for gravity to hit. And I think something like that may be still happening with the private assets, that they are sort of waiting to price things.
So let's talk a little bit about that. There's been a lot of discussion about private markets and the illiquidity premium they get. What are your thoughts on this? Should non-traded assets get an illiquidity premium?
Yeah, so I've written a lot about it, Cliff, of course, also, and more wittily on this. And I think it's dangerous that people think too automatically that if I invest in illiquid investments, I'm going to earn an illiquidity premium. I think after equity premium, that's probably the second most confident statement people would have on long run expected returns. And data doesn't really support it. So we've done lots of empirical evidence on this. And so the logic why the data is then so maybe disappointing is, I think, that people somehow confuse. They think that that the illiquidity is the only important feature. So yes, I think it is fair to require a liquidity premium for locking your money for 10 years. But then there's this other characteristic, lack of mark-to-market, the smoothing service, as I call it. And that may totally offset the amount of excess return that you get. So if there's a 2-3% required liquidity premium for locking money, we might accept the same return for public and private equities, because with the private equities, you don't get the great volatility.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now you also show a chart in the book that shows how the bottom third of illiquid markets have, you know, by definition, they're underperforming the top third, but that gap has just been widening, and it seems like in addition to whatever illiquidity premium are in private markets, there also seems to be a pretty substantial, I don't know if I want to call this quality factor, but the best of the illiquid investments seem to really dramatically outperform the bottom. That spread is much bigger than we might have anticipated otherwise.
So apart from thinking about illiquids overall, one of these great selling points there is the wide dispersion between outperformers and underperformers. And to me, that's such a lovely example of investor overconfidence, that when people see this dispersion, they think, oh, the upside is for me, the downside is for someone else. Right. And so clearly this opportunity involves some risk as well. And it's just somehow that industry doesn't seem to have anybody getting that downside. So sorry, I do think that some investors have got a decent claim to expect to get those top quartile, right? Let's say top half managers. But for others, I think it's better to just think that, okay, if we get the industry level returns, that's reasonable.
So Will Rogers used to always advise people only buy stocks that go up. If they don't go up, don't buy them. Does the same thing apply to private markets? Only invest in private markets that outperform. If they don't outperform, stay away from them.
Yeah.
If it was that simple.
Hindsight is great, but it is so. I would say just positively there that historically, in particular, if we look at private equity, it has a great 35-year history of outperforming S&P 500 by 3% or something like that every year. And that's after 5-6% fees. That gross alpha is just mind-boggling in some sense. But looking ahead, we should be much more cautious because the gap has already been much narrower the last 15 years, and it seems to be narrower because the money was flowing in because of the popularization of the Yale model. Since then, the forward-looking opportunity has been much narrower, and realized opportunity has been much more modest, and the fees are the good old fees. So I think next decade will be more disappointing.
Right, and when we look back to the early days of that outperformance, there were a tiny fraction of the number of funds then. What is it, like 10,000 private equity funds? They used to be numbered in hundreds, not thousands. Same as the hedge fund and the venture capital world. Success has attracted a lot of capital, which leads to underperformance.
Yeah, and one further thing is that these questions were already relevant a few years ago, but private equity did very well the last few years, and I saw Dan Rasmussen wrote quite nicely and sort of recognize. I mean, that's rare and lovely when somebody does. It's sort of post-mortem on my mistake. That's what he did there, and he said that he got it sort of wrong because because they private equity, like hedge funds and especially venture capital, were pushing a lot into the growth sector, and that worked out very well for a few years. And I think to the extent that we are right about the value versus growth, that benefit will turn into disadvantage, I think, in the coming years. And so
really interesting. Yeah. We haven't talked about a couple of other alternatives, credit spreads, commodities. What else are you thinking about in the alt space?
Yeah, I think commodities is the most interesting case. And so I've got a double positive story on that one. The first one is the obvious one, that when we look for inflation hedging investments, they are pretty much the best there is. And right. So most portfolios that invest, most constituents of anybody's portfolio, stocks, bonds, and so on, they have got this inflationary tilt. That was helpful for a long time, but not recently. And so if you want to have a pretty neutral portfolio, you should have some allocation to commodities. Then the second point is that many investors think that you don't earn a positive long-run reward on commodities, but the data says otherwise. Basically,
oh, really?
Yeah, diversified combination of commodity futures has earned something like 3-4% long-run reward. And that's it's a weird thing, and I focus on it in the commodity sector, telling that it's part of it is related to commodity role maybe, but important part is related to diversification returns. So basically, this is getting very geeky, but let me just try. Commodities on a single commodity basis have got 30-40% volatility, which means that type of volatility hurts compound returns a lot. And when you combine lowly correlated commodities together, you can reduce that volatility roughly half it, and you can get this volatility drag much smaller. And so for if as the evidence suggests, that a single commodity has pretty much not outperformed cash in the long run, a portfolio of them has done it because of this saving on this volatility drag thanks to diversification.
So it's a basket of energy and industrial metals and precious metals and foodstuffs and lots of
single ones of them. And so again, you get commodities, you know, these types of effects happen in any investment, on your equities, on your bonds, and so on. It just doesn't matter so much with them because the correlations tend to be higher or volatility is lower. Commodities have got this glorious combination of high volatility and low correlation that makes this really matter.
Huh. Very, very interesting. Let's talk about ESG. There have been some estimates that it's now over $20 trillion. You talk a little bit about ESG investing. Tell us about your thoughts.
Yeah, so it is a clearly growing force, and I would argue also largely a force for good. But the expected return impact is debatable, and so Cliff wrote already a blog a few years ago highlighting this simple logic that, well, one logic is that constraints always should have a cost, but another logic is that if you want to be virtuous and you want to raise the discount rates for sinful companies, well, you do that by maybe investing less in them, or even in some cases you could short them. And so if you do that and you raise their discount rate, you also raise that discount rate is a flip side of expected return.
Makes them more attractive.
Yeah. So somebody else who is willing to basically buy those sinful companies then will earn higher returns. So that is pretty much a long run story that should happen when investors really like something for non-monetary reasons, and that includes ESG. Then I think the reasonable counter argument is that we may be in a transition phase here where we are getting the repricing. How do we get to those higher discount rates? Well, we get it basically by making those companies cheaper. And then we can debate now whether we are in early innings or late innings on that question. So in the long run, I think there will be some cost, and I think most investors who are ESG oriented should be willing to take some cost as a flip side of their virtuous investing. But in between, they might get sort of the win-win outcome that they so like.
Now, you weren't getting the win-win outcome the past 6 months, especially if you were low carbon, low oil. Any of the energy stocks have just done spectacularly the past year. Is that going to be the long-run trade-off? Is that if you're staying away from some of these, you take a chance that there's a big move up in a sector that you've reduced your exposure to?
Yeah, that possibility always exists. And now that we had it, I think it is going to raise more discussions in some organizations than how to deal with any financial trade-off. And I must say that in Europe, I think that investors will largely stay with their ESG beliefs, and there's not going to be a question if they think there's some financial cost, that's okay. In US, there's more doubts, and it has become such a political issue here that it's going to be, I think, harder. Just anything I can say on this one, I think, is that there was a sort of easy travel towards more ESG for the last few years, and now I think we are in a world where it's going to be harder. I think the trend is still the same, but it's going to be more jagged going ahead, and maybe especially so in US.
And before I get to my favorite questions, I gotta throw a curveball at you. Cliff Asness mentioned you like to go in a 120-degree sauna and then jump out and roll around in the snow. Is this a Finnish sort of thing? Tell us about your heat and cold habits.
That is exactly what we do for cheap fun. And sadly, there are fewer opportunities with the global warming, but yeah.
So how hot does the sauna get?
I was thinking whether you are talking Fahrenheit or
Fahrenheit,
centigrade.
But
no, we are talking
water.
No, with centigrade, now we do go close
40
to...
40 degrees, close, 35 degrees?
Yeah, no, we go to 80 to 100 degrees, definitely. So
in centigrade?
Yeah.
So that's like 160, 180...
you'll do the translation there.
Wow.
I think of, you know, the... I do my Fahrenheit and Celsius, not in that area.
But still, 80 degrees is very, very warm.
Yeah, it's nice to sweat there. Yeah.
And then when you jump into the snow, isn't that a little bit of a shock to the system?
Yeah, well, or you go to, polar ice, you go into icy water.
Sure.
That's even better, but that's hard. But yeah, no, it's great fun when you can rarely do that. Yeah,
quite interesting. All right, so let's jump to our favorite questions that we ask all of our guests, starting with, what have you been streaming these days? Tell us about your favorite, whatever kept you entertained during the pandemic, or whatever podcast you listen to.
Sure. Yeah, I thought about this in recent months when I have heard you ask these questions. And by the way, I've gotten some good tips. Yeah, I got Le Bureau and Call My Agent, the French ones, and some Israeli shows from here. So thanks
Fauda
for those.
Yeah, but Fauda was.
Yeah.
That's why I ask it, because, you know, I get to speak to people who have interesting sensibilities. I want to hear what they're seeing and hearing.
Yeah, well, so as a first non-obvious or non-interesting answer, I think, like, recently, I think, well, Better Call Saul, looking forward to the last few episodes, but so that's been great. But I thought that I'd rather highlight then some less well-known older series. So my favorites, I think, in the last 10 years were sort of Slow Burn, The Americans, The Russian Spies, that one, or Rectify. It was a story from southern U.S. and I think lovely stories. You've got to take time for those. And likewise, then in podcasts, I listen a lot to history, and so beyond investing, and I'll just leave. Well, on near investing, I would say Tim Harford's Cautionary Tales is fun, and there's Zingales and Bethany McLean, Capitalism has got very thoughtful topics, so I think they are good. But I love in his history area, I love Dan Carlin, Mike Duncan, Patrick Wyman, and there's a British show called The Rest Is History, which just always makes me laugh.
That's a very interesting list. Let's talk about some of the mentors who helped to shape your career.
Sure. So obviously, I told the dissertation chairman, Fama and French, so they've been very influential in many ways. But I would especially then highlight Marty Leibovitz. So all before, during, and after Salomon years. So, and he's such a mensch that it's wonderful to have known him for decades.
What about books? What are some of your favorites, and what are you reading right now?
Yeah, so I am a voracious reader. Lots of investing fiction, nonfiction, all kinds of things. I will highlight from fiction, really big one, Hilary Mantel's trilogy on Thomas Cromwell, Wolf Hall. I was thinking, I think maybe I heard in your show also, The Three-Body Problem, very different, the sci-fi, the Chinese one. So I think that was great. And then on nonfiction, I think the most impressive book I read in the last couple of years was Joe Henrich's The Weirdest People in the World. So this is weird is Western educated, rich democratic, and it's basically telling telling how different the people who are most often studied in various psychological studies, the Western University students, how different they are from most cultures. Right. And then it's explaining why things went that way. And it's both parts of the story are very interesting, but again, a very long book.
Really, really intriguing.
Yeah, and currently, Zach Carter, I think, is the author of the book on Keynes, Price of Peace. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Good. That's a pretty good list. What sort of advice would you give to a recent college graduate who is interested in a career in either investing, finance, value, quantitative investing? How would you advise them?
I'll go with the old-fashioned, I think, like, don't sacrifice your ethics, that integrity matters.
Mm-hmm. But that's really good advice. And our final question, what do you know about the world of investing today that you wish you knew 30 or so years ago when you were first getting started?
I'll say this lightly, that bond yields can go negative. You know, didn't expect that to happen. But the funny thing is that I thought that really, I would have then expected that to coincide with bearish equity markets. But in 2010, it actually happened with a big bull market. So it wasn't that equities equity weakness pushed bond yields down, but it was that low bond yields pushed equities up. So causality went that way, and that's surprising. So I think that's one. And then another serious point is how important and how hard patience is. Mm-hmm. So with all of these ideas, I talk about these long run strategies, and you just it doesn't matter too much if you don't have the stickiness. So I think one has to really calibrate one's investment to the amount of patience one can reasonably expect to have.
Huh, really, really intriguing. We have been speaking with Antti Ilmanen, co-head of Portfolio Solutions at AQR. If you enjoy this conversation, well, check out any of our previous 400 or so podcasts. You can find those at iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your favorite podcasts. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. You can sign up for my daily reading list at ritholtz.com. Follow me on Twitter at ritholtz. I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack team that helps put these conversations together each week. Justin Milliner is my audio engineer. Atika Valbrun is my project manager. Sean Russo is my head of research. Paris Wald is my producer. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.